of the talk is who pays for social care. But in fact, the talk is not going to be about social care, but about who pays for it or how it's paid for, and how all government expenditure is paid for, and something to, on the what the Labour Party and even the media now are calling the current cost of living crisis. So I want to start, if you click slide one, which is about the basic features of the present day economic system. Well, some of them are more basic than that. I mean, the first one, that all new wealth is produced by humans working on materials that originally came from nature. I mean, I would have thought that this was self-evident, that the only way that new wealth can be produced is by work, by humans working. I mean, that's what wealth is, anything that is used by humans. And production is humans transforming materials that originally came from nature into something that they want or need. I mean, I can't think of any other way in which things can be produced. I mean, this is the case in any human society, including capitalism, and will be the case in socialism too. Obviously, before capitalism, the producers were slaves or serfs working the land. Under capitalism, they are mainly wage workers, but they're also the self-employed, such as peasants working on their own land, or independent workers selling some product or service. I mean, the claim that it is enterprising capitalists who are wealth producers is absurd. In fact, it's insulting both to workers and to the intelligence. Now, the second point, the governments produce no wealth and so have to obtain what they use from others, either by taxation or borrowing. I mean, governments exist to administer the common affairs of the ruling class of any society, but because they produce nothing, they have to obtain these resources from those who produce or who have acquired wealth. In some pre-capitalist societies, this was done by directly taxing, often in kind, the direct producers. In capitalism, it's done by a combination of taxation and borrowing. In any event, what the government consumes ultimately comes out of what the producers produce. I should add, of course, that some governments do run their own profit-making businesses, but that's not as a government. That's as a capitalist. Governments as governments, they produce no wealth. I'll leave the third one for the moment because that's the one I want to concentrate on later. Now, the fourth one is the cost of living is going up all the time due to a fall in the value of money. Now, this is deliberate. In fact, it's government policy nearly everywhere to devalue the purchasing power of money by 2 to 3% a year. I mean, in Britain, it's 2%. I mean, this is the last remaining legacy of Keynesianism in public policy. Keynes cynically noted that workers resist a direct cut in money wages more than a fall in real wages due to inflation, and proposed a slowly rising inflation to take advantage of this. I mean, 2% a year, it's 2% a year compound. So if my calculations are correct, over 10 years, the money prices will go up 20%, whereas over 30 years, it will go off 50%. So I think in the end, with this inflation thing, Boris's promise of a high money wage economy will be realized. I'm going to come, if you come to the second slide now, which is not from me, we'll explain the third point, that wages reflect the cost of living as a worker. This is what I want to concentrate on, because it's a key to understanding why capitalism can never be reformed so as to work in the interest of the wage working class, and why therefore socialism is necessary. So what is the cost of living of a worker? It's the money cost of buying what is needed to recreate and maintain the physical and mental energy the workers exercise in production, often called even by non-Marxists, labor power. Now, this quote from Investopedia. It brings out the fact that the cost of living is not the same as the standard living. I mean, the standard of living is the actual goods and services that workers consume to recreate and maintain their mental and physical energy. For example, in this quote from Investopedia, the standard of living in the other city than New York might be the same, even though the cost of living is less. In fact, it could even be higher. There's one sentence in this definition. The cost of living is tied to wages. I'd put it rather the other way around, that wages are tied to the cost of living, because it's wages that follow changes in the cost of living. If the cost of living goes up, then wages will tend to do so as well. And if they don't, then workers would not be getting enough to properly recreate and maintain their labor power, and vice versa. If the cost of living goes down, then so too will wages tend to. So first, the cost of living goes up or down, and wages follow. Now, this is where the fourth point about this permanent inflation comes in. Because of this, the cost of living is rising all the time, which means that the pressure on employers is not to reduce money wages if the cost of living fell, but simply not to increase them fully in line with inflation. Look, the cost of living can go up for various reasons. It goes up mainly when the price of what workers must buy to recreate and maintain their energy goes up. I mean, this can happen for other reasons than this permanent low-level inflation. For instance, when a government tax, such as excise duty, as on the cigarettes and tobacco, or VAT, or a sales tax, increases, this will increase the price of what workers must buy. I mean, the cost of living can also go down. Now, as I say, in this age of permanent inflation, this would show itself as the cost of living not rising as fast as inflation. I mean, the cost of living is reduced when the government subsidizes or provides free something that enters into workers' consumption. I mean, rent control would be one example. Free transport would be another. Family allowances, UBI, and also abolishing tariffs on imports consumed by workers would have this effect too. I mean, the classic example of this is the abolition of the corn laws in the middle of the 19th century. I mean, those canvassing for this, for working class support for this, said it would bring cheap food. I mean, it did bring cheap food, but it also was brought about reduced in the cost of living, and so lower money wages, even if the standard of living remained the same. Now, some of the Brexiteers are using the same argument today, saying that free trade deals with other states could bring down the cost of imported food, but if it did, it would exert downward pressure on wages. Now, there are some taxes that workers pay directly. There's a reference to this in the Investopedia definition. It says it includes housing, food taxes, and healthcare. And workers do pay taxes in the sense that they have to fork out from their own pocket. I mean, you can think of some. I mean, there's council taxes, car tax, TV license. And think these taxes, which workers pay directly out of their pocket, do enter into the cost of living. So when they're imposed for the first time, this will increase the cost of living, and so generate economic pressure for money wages to go up. But what this means then, of course, is that the taxes are passed on in this way to employers who ultimately pay them. Now, what about taxes that are on paid directly out of wages rather than indirectly on the things which workers buy? So if you go to slide three, I mean, the classical political economists were quite clear on this. This is David Ricardo, who was a capitalist, talking about what happens if the direct tax will be imposed on wages. I mean, he says quite clearly and explicitly here that it will diminish the rate of profits. He says a tax on wages is wholly a tax on profits. Well, a tax on the necessaries is partly a tax on profits and partly a tax on rich consumers. That's the tax taxes I was just talking about, the ones that are levied on goods that workers consume to maintain their labour power. And he says the ultimate effects which result from such taxes is precisely the same as those result from a direct tax on profits. So that's the case if there's a direct tax on profits. If you switch to the third and last slide, this is from Marx himself, writing 30 years later in 1847. He deals with a situation where workers already pay taxes on their wages, and what would happen if these were to be abolished. Well, he says either the employer's profit would rise as a direct consequence by the same quantity, or else there'd be just a change in the form of tax collecting. In other words, instead of the capitalists paying the workers more to pay the taxes, the capitalists would pay them directly to the state. So that's the end of the slides. So up until the start of World War II, most workers didn't pay income tax on their wages because the wages weren't high enough to reach the threshold at which it became payable. I mean, some workers did, some professional people in professional jobs did, but during the war and to help pay for it, PAYE, pay as you earn, was introduced. Now, under this scheme, the taxes normally imposed on wages were deducted by the employer before they paid their workers, when it was collected and paid to the government by employers, instead of, as in Marx's example, being paid to the workers for them to pay out of their own pockets. Now, there's another advantage for capitalism in the pay-as-you-earn system. I mean, it enables workers to receive take-home pay appropriate to their individual circumstances. I mean, since it costs a single person less to recreate and maintain their labour power than the person with dependent children, it is inefficient from a capitalist point of view to pay them both the same amount. I mean, income tax payable through pay-as-you-earn allows this anomaly to be abolished by reducing the take-home pay, which is their effective wage, of a single person below that of a person with dependent children. I mean, employers could never do this off their own bat, but they have to offer the same wage rate to all workers, equal pay for equal work. But this only applies to the headline wage or salary offered. Pay-as-you-earn income tax means that this principle is nullified. Equal pay for equal work doesn't exist in practice, as the take-home pay of workers doing the same job is not the same if their family circumstances differ. So capitalism, pay-as-you-earn system, removes that anomaly from a capitalist point of view. But in any event, it's fair and it's also economically correct to say that workers don't pay income tax, direct income taxes on their wages. They never see the money to pay it. It's not part of the wages they receive. What they've got to live on is their take-home pay. This is what they have to use to buy what they need to recreate and maintain their labour power. Now, revealingly enough, when the cost of living is calculated, go back to to slide two, income tax and social security contributions, which are really another tax, they're not taken into account. It's not pre-wages that are used, but take-home pay. So changes in these taxes not taken into account either when calculating indexes of the change in prices, such as the consumer price index or the retail price index. In other words, Even orthodox academic economists and national statisticians accept that in practice, workers don't pay income tax or national insurance contributions that are deducted by their employer. Employers pay them literally and economically. So the point here is, what is linked to the cost of living is take-home pay. It's the bottom line on the payslip, not the top line. Now, all the same, an increase in income tax or national insurance does represent a decrease in take-home pay. But in so far as it results in wages not being enough to buy what workers need to recreate and maintain their labour power, it exerts an upward pressure on wages. I mean, this is not automatic or immediate. Workers have to take the initiative if they want their wages to go up more quickly than the impersonal operation of market force will bring about. I mean, these impersonal forces are now bringing about an increase, as we know, in the wages of HGV drivers. So anyway, organizing as in trade unions to push up wages is the way to respond to such a fall in take-home pay brought about by the government increasing income tax or national insurance. The only alternative would be to try to campaign to get the government not to increase the tax, but I think much more effective will be trade union action. So it does make sense to say that in the end, all taxes on what workers buy or which they pay directly or are levied on their gross wages are in the end paid by employers in the form of higher take-home pay and so out of profits. So taxes are not a burden on the working class. So to summarise this part, taxes on goods that workers buy enter into the cost of living to which wages are tied and so get passed on to the employer as high wages. Taxes that workers do pay out of their pockets also enter into the cost of living and have the same effect as taxes on the goods that they buy and consume. Taxes deducted by employers before they pay workers are literally not paid by workers, but are a direct tax on employers. And finally, any measures that reduce the cost of living also reduce money wages because of the economic link between wages and the cost of living. This can happen, as I say, without affecting the standard living. I need to make an important proviso here. This only applies to wage earners. The link does not exist for the self-employed. They have to pay any taxes levied on them, and there's no economic mechanism to nullify or compensate for this. The same applies to any tax on benefits and pensions. When pensioners have to pay more due to a tax increase, whether direct or indirect, I say there's no economic tendency for their pensions to go up. Whether or not they do is a purely political decision. Now, it's true that given permanent inflation, the government will eventually have to increase benefits and pensions. I mean, in some countries, these are linked to inflation. And this is the case in Britain for state pensions with the famous triple lock, which gives pensioners an annual increase, either of the increase in the consumer price index or the increase in average wages or 2.5%, whichever is the greatest, which guarantees that they get an annual increase of at least 2.5%. Now, politicians control whether these pensions and benefits go up, and they promise to protect people against rises in the cost of living. This means part of their stock in trade. I mean, the Labour Party at the moment, as I said at the beginning, is talking about a cost of living crisis with all gas prices and things like that going up. Now, the Tories promised at the last election not to increase income tax, VAT, or national insurance. I mean, they may well have honoured this had it not been for the pandemic, but voters were led to understand that their standard of living and their take-home take-home pay permitted them would be protected. But what this election promise didn't promise was that they would not be threatened, their standard of living would not be threatened by continual low-level inflation. I mean, it was assumed that this would continue at 2% or so a year. And it has, though, at the moment, the Bank of England thinks it might reach 4% at some point in the fairly near future. So workers, despite the promises made by politicians and governments, they still have to struggle to ensure that their take-home pay keeps up with the rise of the cost of living. And as I said, the best way to do this is through trade union action. That was the main point I wanted to make, that wages are tied to the cost of living and move with it. And that's an economic fact of capitalism, which means that workers will never get more, at least not for long, than what it costs to recreate and maintain their labour power. As I say, it's an economic law of capitalism. It might even be called the law of wages, and no government can ignore or get around it. It's why capitalism cannot be reformed so as to benefit workers. I mean, measures such as free transport or universal income or cheaper food imports lead to a fall in money wages, as they, once again, even if the standard of living remains the same. Finally, to answer the question in the notice for this talk, who will pay the increase in national insurance contributions to pay for social care? Well, in the end, it's employers who will pay this out of their profits. Right, that's it. Thanks.